IFPRI Policy Seminar, Why Poverty Persists, Poverty Dynamics in Asia and Africa, held on May 30, 2012, in Washington, D.C. Speaker Bob Balch, Professor of Economics at Tan Tau University, Vietnam.
What I'm going to be talking about this afternoon is this book, Why Poverty Persists, which was published last year in hardback by Edward Elgar last summer, and it will be coming out in paperback this summer. And there should be some flyers for the book, which you can collect as you come in or as you go out. This was work which I did, as John mentioned, when I was leading the poverty dynamics and economic mobility theme for the Chronic Poverty Research Center. And in that theme, we work very closely with IFPRI, in particular with the Pathways to Poverty program. And our component of that research was funded by the UK government, UK aid. So here is the flyer of the book. I just want to mention that the way we define poverty dynamics in terms of the book is the processes by which people and households move in and out of poverty over time. In terms of an overview of the book, the main thing we do is using six different long-term panel surveys. These are longitudinal surveys spanning periods of between 6 and 18 years, but mostly over 10 years. We look at what traps people in chronic poverty and what allows them to escape from it. And it all comes from the CPRC theme work I just mentioned. There are six country studies in the book. You can see what those six countries are, four from Asia and two from Africa, three of which are IFPRI pathway panels. I won't talk about some of the difficult technical issues which we faced in analyzing panel surveys, but I do just want to mention that we did pay careful attention to the issues of attrition and tracking, to measurement error, and to how you model poverty dynamics in all of the chapters of the book. And so there's comparative things you can look at in terms of that in the book. Now, within the Chronic Poverty Research Center, we've defined chronic poverty as extended duration poverty, measured in absolute terms. This doesn't have to be a monetary definition of poverty, although it turns out that all the country studies in the book do use an expenditure-based definition of poverty using an absolute cost of basic needs approach. One of the critical insights in the book is that chronic poverty is basically based on a stocks and flows relationship. So if you want to reduce chronic poverty, you need to do two things. You need to increase the flows of people who are escaping it while decreasing the flows of non-poor people who enter chronic poverty. And so that leads to three questions around which I'm going to focus my discussion. What enables people to escape chronic poverty? What traps them in chronic poverty? And what leads people to fall into it? And on each of these topics, I will have two slides. The first is a summary, and then the second is some pictures just to liven things up a little bit. So, the first of those three, what enables people to escape chronic poverty? Well, the first thing we found across the six studies in the book is that the processes which enable people to escape chronic poverty are gradual. And they're not smooth processes, the sorts of processes of accumulation which you might read about in economic theory. Instead, they are often sawtooth trajectories in which accumulation is interrupted by short-term setbacks, short-term shocks, and negative events. We also found that households who escape chronic poverty or escape poverty are often at early stages of their life cycle. So you might like to think of an example of a newly married couple here. When they're initially married, particularly before they have children, they're often doing quite well. They don't have too many liabilities. They can both go out to work, etc. But then when children come along, pressures start to build. Children have to be educated. Spouses, normally the woman, have to stay at home to do more work there in terms of childcare. And then very often on top of that, particularly in the sort of societies we're talking about with extended families, elderly parents will come to live and they will bring more stresses and strains. So very often what we found was that households escaped poverty early on in their life cycle before falling back into it later on. So there's strong life cycle effects. A family member obtaining regular employment, and it doesn't matter whether that employment is formal or informal, as long as the income which is derived from it is fairly regular, was a very strong correlate of escaping from chronic poverty, as was establishing a successful non-farm business. And finally, we found out that the causes of improvement for some are causes of decline for others. A particularly good example of this is microcredit, where despite all the, if you like, hype which has been said about microcredit, we found that some households, particularly chronically poor households, were extremely reluctant to incur the liability which microcredit incurred. So these are three pictures just to illustrate what is happening here. To illustrate employment, we have some ladies harvesting sugarcane in Thanh Hoa in central Vietnam. To illustrate a non-farm business, we have herding cattle to market. I think this is in Amhara in Ethiopia. And then here we have a microcredit worker in Sindh in Pakistan. So moving on to the second question, what traps people in chronic poverty? Well, first of all, we found that lack of assets, broadly defined, are crucial maintainers of chronic poverty, things which lock people in for a long time. Lack of education was particularly important here, as was ethnicity, caste, and race. And that particular relationship, that triplet of ethnicity, caste, and race, it plays out differently in different countries, was one of the strongest correlates of chronic poverty in five of the six countries in the book. We also found that adverse geography, customs, and social obligations played important roles in perpetuating chronic poverty. A good example of customs and social obligations which perpetuate chronic poverty is dowries in South Asia. We found particularly in the Bangladesh work, also in the Pakistan work, that the burden which they represented, also how that combined with the life cycle, was a very strong negative event for many households. However, we found fairly limited evidence of there being a threshold in terms of the Carter and Barrett theory, for those of you who are familiar with that, of an asset threshold, either in terms of land or non-land assets, beyond which households were more likely to escape from chronic poverty. So again, here are three pictures to illustrate those points. Here we have an elderly lady who's illiterate in Manigange in Bangladesh. Here we have three Nung women who are ethnic minority group in northern Vietnam selling firewood. And here we have some ladies carrying water in Cape Province in South Africa to represent the remoteness and adverse geography. Third question, what leads people to fall into chronic poverty? Well, here we found that rather than being a single large shock, it was often two or three negative events happening in rapid succession, which usually propel households into chronic poverty. Now, I use the word negative events rather than shocks because some of the things which are pressures on households, dowries is a good example, are actually partially predictable. If you have a daughter in South Asia, you know that you're probably going to have to make a large payment at the time she gets married and roughly when that's going to happen. If you live in a cyclone-prone area, you know that one year you're going to be hit by cyclones. So that's why we describe these as negative events rather than simply as shocks. We found that in non-arid, humid, if you like, tropical environments, negative events at the household level were usually more important than community and area level shocks. But in contrast, in arid and semi-arid environments, I'm particularly thinking here of the studies in Ethiopia and in Pakistan, community area level shocks, in particular drought, were of greater importance. Lack of education, as well as education being a strong correlate of people moving out of poverty, lack of education made individuals much more vulnerable to fall into chronic poverty. And then in South Asia, from some of the work which Agnes did in Bangladesh, we found that a lack of brothers or close male relatives was also strongly associated with females, in particular widows, falling into chronic poverty. So once again, here are three pictures to illustrate this. We have some floods in central Vietnam. We have a drought. I believe this is in Wollo in Ethiopia. And then this final picture here is of an earth worker in Sindh in Pakistan with three daughters. He happened to have not many other male relatives. And so he was quite concerned about what he was going to actually do when the negative events of these four daughters' dowries happened in 10 or so years' time. Now, I'd like to spend the remaining time which I have talking about some extended policy conclusions. What can be done about chronic poverty? And I think the first thing to be said is that it's very difficult to advance blueprint solutions, silver bullets, if you like, for reducing chronic poverty, because context is really, really important in all of the rural areas in which we talked, in which we looked. However, there were certain themes which did recur time and time again in the six country studies, and we can draw certain policy conclusions and suggestions and strategies from that. I'd also like to remind you of this stocks and flows relationship. Reducing chronic poverty should involve decreasing the stock of people trapped in chronic poverty while increasing the flows of people escaping it and decreasing the flows entering it. So that leads to the two questions you have at the bottom there. What can you do to promote escapes from chronic poverty, and what can you do to prevent descents into chronic poverty? So in the book, in the final chapter, we talk about an economic manifesto for the chronically poor, which has both a promotive and a preventative component. In terms of what can be done to promote escapes from chronic poverty, I think the first thing which should be said is that while growth is good, it is not enough. You'll all be familiar with the analogy that a rising tide raises all boats. But think about this for a minute. What about the boats which are damaged in some way, or old, have problems with navigation, etc.? What happens when the tide rises then? They get stuck in the mud, they drift off, okay? Possibly they go underwater. And there are certain, I think, interesting parallels between the chronically poor and those damaged boats. Now, one important group within the chronically poor are going to be disadvantaged and marginalized groups, particularly identified by the ethnicity, caste, race triplet. And they are particularly likely to be excluded from the benefits of growth. That's what came strongly out of all the studies in the book. And this indicates that there is a need for meso-level measures to ensure that the benefits of growth are spread widely. The sorts of things which I'm talking about when I mention meso-level measures are things like rural feeder roads, or the access and functioning of large-scale irrigation systems, or telecommunications and market information systems to counter remoteness and adverse geography, or urban planning in an urban setting. All of those can play important roles in helping to spread growth more widely. And then also, it's important to distinguish between measures which improve the returns to the chronically poor's existing endowments and those which enhance their asset base, which is what I talk about in the next slide. My former colleague from the University of Sussex, who was also a division director here for a short time, Michael Lipton, liked to say labor is the poor's most abundant asset. And if you follow along with that line of reasoning, then measures which improve the returns to chronically poor people's labor are essential. So here we mention labor and migration policies. In some of the countries where I work, for example, Vietnam, restrictions on migration, okay, are an extreme burden to chronically poor people. Employment guarantee and workfare schemes also have a very important role to play in providing employment, particularly in the agricultural off-season. And here I think it's important to mention two programs, cash for work programs operating at scale, which are having large impacts on the chronically poor. The Productive Safety Net program in Ethiopia, many people in Italy know about that, and also the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act in India. Both of these are programs which are making a big impact on the able-bodied chronically poor. More controversially, measures such as minimum wage policies and anti-discrimination initiatives can do a lot to increase the returns which these excluded and marginalized groups receive for their labor. And then we have measures to improve the asset base of the chronically poor. And here, what comes out of the evidence in the book is that asset accumulation usually involves trading up activities. Rural households will very often start by some small-scale cash crops or perhaps livestock activities. They will then move into some form of agricultural processing, trading of activities, then into non-farm businesses. They will try and educate their children so that they can get wage jobs when they grow up. So this is all a process of trading up assets. And in this, complementary assets, particularly when you're looking at agricultural activities, are crucial. Microfinance and social funds may be useful in this respect as well, but I say may be useful because of these negative aspects which we did mention earlier. Now, what can be done to prevent descent into chronic poverty? Well, the first thing to say is that in most countries, social safety nets tend to consist of a myriad of ad hoc interventions. They're usually designed to protect people against very specific shocks. But as we saw earlier, descents into poverty often happen after two or three shocks happen very quickly, one after the other. So what this implies is that broader social protection policies, which can provide protection against a range of risks, are going to be very important in terms of preventing descents into chronic poverty. In particular, there is a need to weave together social safety nets with other social protection programs to provide minimum living standards. This is the essential underpinnings of the ILO's Social Protection Floor initiative. Also important that social safety net programs, particularly things like employment guarantee schemes, can complement each other and be scaled up and down very quickly. In terms of protecting the asset base of the poor and the near poor against erosion in times of crisis, I've already mentioned employment guarantee schemes and workfare schemes, in particular the PSNP in Ethiopia and NREGA in India. But for people who are not able to engage in labor as actively as others, the less able-bodied poor, if you like, there's a lot of evidence that both conditional and unconditional transfers can have a major impact on reducing chronic poverty, both in terms of the immediate cash transfers which they make to poor households, which they can rely on, and also in terms of improving the education and health of children so that children of chronically poor parents are not necessarily trapped in poverty themselves. This reduces the intergenerational transmission of poverty. Bolsa Familia in Brazil, Progresso Oportunidades in Mexico, many other CTTs are good examples of that. And in some cases, and again, please note the sum, contributory social insurance schemes can play a big impact in terms of, have a big impact in terms of preventing descents into chronic poverty. I say may because in many countries, social insurance schemes actually have a very narrow base. They are confined basically to civil servants and wage employees. Those people are not likely, very likely to be chronically poor in the first place. But there are examples of social insurance schemes which have been spread much, much more widely. For example, in Vietnam, the government continues to pay VSI contributions for people who become unemployed, also for elderly and infirm people, for poor households, etc. So again, that's providing protection against a range of shocks. What is crucial in all of this is that social protection programs must be both credible and reliable. Households must feel that they're able to ensure that they will be there in times of crises, particularly these composite crises. Okay, because that will both reduce downward mobility and also encourage households to take the risks to engage in the more remunerative but also more risky activities which will lead them onto upward mobility trajectories. So, my final slide. There's a famous and I always think depressing statement in St. Mark's Gospel, that the poor ye shall always have with you. If poverty is defined in relative terms, it's difficult to see how this statement is not true. It's probably unavoidable. You've only got to look at the correlation between national poverty lines and GNP per capita across countries. However, if poverty is defined in absolute terms, as we do in the book, as many development economists like to do, I believe that it is possible to talk about the reduction and in the long term, perhaps even the elimination of chronic poverty. And I hope that what I've said in this brief overview has demonstrated that reducing chronic poverty requires what we might describe as a transformative approach to development, in which equitable access to employment, broad-based investments in education and human capital more generally, and effective social protection all have central roles. Thank you very much.